And we welcome you to the Tuesday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. Just about everybody who lives here in southeastern Wisconsin in the Kenosha-Racine area knows something of the DeKoven Center, one of the most beautiful corners of the city of Racine, perched right there on the shores of Lake Michigan. Gorgeous grounds, gorgeous buildings. But I think for many of us, we scarcely know anything about the man for whom that beautiful campus is named, James DeKoven. We are going to be exploring his life and his legacy for the next few minutes with John Magaris, a former university professor and historian who has written a very important biography of James DeKoven called James DeKoven, Biography of a Famous Yet Forgotten Man. And what a beautiful turn of phrase that subtitle is. And it speaks to what has been, in a sense, a case of some neglect. Although some people have written about Mr. DeKoven, Father DeKoven, and his life and legacy, there is much that has not been explored in a way that his life merits. So I'm very excited for this opportunity to speak with Dr. Magaris about this work, about this book, and the labor of love, which I'm sure it was for him. He speaks in the introduction about his nearly lifelong interest in history and his volunteer work at the Racine County Historical Museum and as an archivist at the DeKoven Center, which, if I remember correctly, was a chief inspiration for him to sit down and pen this biography. Again, titled James DeKoven, Biography of a Famous Yet Forgotten Man. John Magaris, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you very much. It's nice to be here. I appreciate your invitation and for your introduction very much.
So ahead of us talking about James DeKoven, let's talk just a little bit about John Magaris. Tell our listeners a little bit about where you came from originally, where you were born and where you were raised, and ultimately how Racine ended up figuring in your life.
I keep saying that I keep moving north, but I was born and raised in Oklahoma, in Oklahoma City. My parents were both born in that one, my dad born when it was a territory, my mother right after it became a state. And I did my university graduate work at the University of Kansas. And then in 1976, I was hired by the University of Wisconsin-La Crosse. And I went there to teach French and Spanish at that time, eventually. And I had all my career at the University of Wisconsin-La Crosse, retired after 28 years. I retired as the dean of the college of was called the College of Liberal Studies, which was the College of General Studies as well as history and so forth and so on, all of the humanities. So,
I read something that you said about being an administrator that just made my heart sing, and it was just such an interesting way to think about it, because I think for a lot of us, even those of us who are actually in higher education, we don't necessarily think of the work of most administrators as being particularly pleasurable or exciting. It can sometimes be brutally difficult and perhaps in some cases even tedious. And yet you write about it in very winning fashion and say at one point, the wonderful thing about being an administrator is that it opens up the richness of the university to you. Can you talk about what those words mean or what you're getting at about that richness that you otherwise would not have fully experienced if you had remained only a teacher there?
Well, one of the things that always struck me as a university professor when I got on committees that were a little bit more outside the area where I was specializing was that you don't learn about what other people are doing at the university when you're in your own department. And when I became dean, I issued every year, I had a large luncheon for all of the faculty and employees of the college, and I issued sort of just on a whim what I called the Magaris Challenge. Well, I didn't call it the Magaris Challenge. Someone else called it the Magaris Challenge. But what it was is every semester, I challenged people in the college to do something that they normally wouldn't do. If they were teaching music, go to a football game. If they were teaching art history, go to a presentation of a play in another language. It was, and I just found out recently that this year, I started this in 2002. I found that it's been going on since I left. The current provost does the same thing every year, and she calls it the Magaris Challenge.
Wow.
And the students have taken it on, and there's a group of students this year that had a course in which they were all doing the Magaris Challenge. They were doing something outside the realm of comfort. And the richness of a university should not be limited to the one area where one is studying or where one is working. So this was made me feel very, very good that it was going on. So that's the story. And it's true. It's just there's so much going on. People work so hard that it needs to be recognized outside of their realm.
So. Absolutely. I couldn't agree more. I want to ask you something else about your own background. If I remember correctly, when you went to college, it was primarily to study French. Is that
well,
right?
I went to college to study, I think. And it just happened that when it came time to declare a major, I had a lot of hours in French, and I loved it. It was something that I'd continue to do as I at one point was even contemplating the mathematics challenge, which my relatives will all find amazingly challenging for me would have been. But and so I enjoyed French. I enjoyed languages. I enjoyed history. The problem was I enjoyed everything, and it was difficult sometimes to make decisions. So that's the sum total of it was that it was a good thing. It's been a wonderful experience I did my doctoral work in French history.
Right.
French civilization studies, actually.
Very good. Tell us about this interest in history. I know, and from glancing at the preface to the book, I mean, you make mention of some of the work you've did as a volunteer at the Racine County Heritage Museum, and then eventually an archivist at Dukovin. I want to talk about that a little later. But
sure.
But more generally, your interest in history, can we trace that to anything in particular?
I think I personally trace it to growing up with a grandmother in the house who had come to the United States in the 1890s, and who was from Hungary, and was basically a very loving woman who grew up in very close to my family. But she also told wonderful stories about life on the prairie of South Dakota, where she came. When she came from Hungary. And so I think that sparked an interest in me, in history, in who was this lady. I wish I had been able, as we all do, we all experience this, wish we had asked more questions. Mm. But when you're 4 years old and your grandmother is telling you about living in a sod house, you don't have the right knowledge to ask the right questions. But so I think that's where my interest in history comes from.
Right, very good. Explain again your connection with the city of Racine.
My partner and life partner is well known in Racine. He's teacher of French at the Prairie School, and he ended his career there as the head of the upper school. So he was an educational administrator too. So we both were teachers of French as well as administrators.
So you knew each other in a sense, kind of in that professional. That's how you met.
We met at a seminar in Madison, Wisconsin, which brought together 30 teachers of French, 15 university-level teachers of French, and 15 high school teachers of French. It was the summer we spent a month together, these 30 people, talking about teaching of languages and especially teaching of French at that time. It was a wonderful experience.
And he was from Racine,
and
so
he
that
was from Racine, and I was from La Crosse. Yeah. He was one of the high school teachers, and I was one of the university level teachers.
So you had the two borders of Wisconsin well covered. That's
right.
The two of you.
Yes.
Very good. So, for those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with John Magaris, And he will be familiar, I'm sure, to many of you, a former professor and then administrator at the University of Wisconsin-La Crosse, well-known for his activity in Racine, and the author of a new book about James DeCoven, titled James DeCoven, Biography of a Famous Yet Forgotten Man. And this, of course, would be the well-known Episcopalian priest and educator for whom the DeCoven Center in Racine is proudly named. In the preface, you make reference to the fact that you were an archivist at the DeCoven Center. First of all, was that a kind of an official title, or was that something you were just kind of doing for fun on the side?
Well, it eventually became an official title, and that now there's someone who has that same title who has been hired into that position. It was a voluntary opportunity for me to help with discovering what type of documents actually were housed at the DeCoven Center. And it came about because several boxes, I think there were 13 boxes, large boxes of documents, were moved from the Milwaukee County Historical Society to the DeCoven Center at the time when Max Dersham was the executive director. The Milwaukee County Historical Society was running out of shelving space, and they were looking, and they didn't want to dispose of documents, especially if those documents belonged to an organization that was still functioning. And because DeCoven Center is not in Milwaukee, they felt that they no longer wanted to have the responsibility of housing those documents. So Max Dersham asked me to look through these documents to see if I thought they were of any value. And of course, I think any historical document is valuable. It's hard to throw documents away. If you'd come and look in my basement in La Crosse, you would understand that. But so that's how I got involved in that. I was just going through those documents, and they were, we had just some basic problems that we had to resolve. Like most of the documents still had paper clips or staples, and those tend to rust and destroy paper. Hmm. So my first few years were just devoted to cleaning up this treasure trove of documents and making them ready for preservation over the years.
So were all of these boxes filled with documents that, at least in some respect, pertinent to the DeCoven Center? I mean, had they been set aside because of that?
They, when at various times over the years, as different people took over the DeCoven Center, because it had different concepts about what it was doing. It started out as a young men's college in, try to get my dates right, 1752, I believe, 1852, sorry. 1852, mm-hmm. Started out as a men's college, and then it became a men's college and boys' school, and James DeCoven took over in when he moved to, he first moved to Neshota, and then came to Racine to take over as the president of Racine College. It stayed a college until the end of the 1880s, and then it became a boys' school. And in the 1930s, a community of Anglican nuns took over, and they were the ones who named it the DeCoven Center. So each time that there was a sort of a change of regime or a change of the function of the buildings that were the Racine College, sometimes those documents were housed and moved, and eventually moved to Milwaukee County Historical Society because it was recognized as one of the central organizations of preservations of documents in this area.
So these nine boxes, they all had something do with the DeCoven Center.
Yeah.
So you're not weeding through things that had no relevance whatsoever. But you were still charged with the question of what matters most here, what do we want to be sure to preserve? And it sounds like your gut instinct was to, in a sense, preserve it all.
Exactly. Unfortunately, but exactly. But you know, it's hard, it's difficult to make some decisions about different documents. you know, you don't want to keep receipts for 2 pounds of butter. But I mean, and we found things like that, but a lot of it had been gone through over the years by different other people. So it wasn't quite that much a housekeeping project.
Right. So you say in the preface to your new book, the biography of James DeCoven, that it was in your work in the archive at DeCoven Center that you really became inspired by the notion of writing about him. Can you trace that to anything in particular? I don't mean to presume it would be like some single document that, you know, this magical thing happened, but over the course of this exploration, I mean, what was it about that experience, that work as an archivist, that ultimately did inspire this project?
Well, one of the things that was really sort of brought about my curiosity about his life was the fact that there really was nothing, not a very complete biography of him that had been written prior to this time when I came on board. I asked when I first arrived, well, do you have a biography that you could give me? I knew nothing about James DeCoven. I knew his name, but I didn't, so it was completely neophyte as far as his life. And as I started going through documents, I found that I wasn't alone in that. There was the last really attempt to write more or less complete biography was in the end of the 19th century, in the 1899. So I was trying to find information for myself primarily. So that's why it was that particular thing. Well, who is this man? Why are these series of buildings named after him? And who exactly was he?
Yeah. It sounds like you yourself, at least at that time, was not Episcopalian?
No, I'm not.
Okay. I mentioned to you before we went on the air, I have an uncle, he's passed away now, but he was an Episcopalian priest. Right. The rest of my family is Lutheran, but my Uncle Paul went off into that direction instead. And I have a cousin who has a middle name, DeCoven, John DeCoven Benedict Berg. And so I've known that name for a long time, even as a Lutheran, but knew next to nothing. And like many Racinians, have driven past the DeCoven Center hundreds, if not thousands of times without really knowing the full story. At one point in the preface of the book, you write, "This biography of James DeCoven is essentially my response to what has been written and what has not been written about his life." Before we dig into the details, just in general, what was missing that you felt needed to be, in a sense, corrected or rectified?
Well, one of the things is that he seemed to have, if you read the different biographies and short biographies, and I mean, this sometimes very short, 3 or 4 pages, it seems that he just sort of plopped down in the middle of Wisconsin, and there's no background. The only person, and this came about only in 2002, was a Episcopal priest by the name of Lawrence Crum, who was a librarian. He wrote a little bit more complete biography, I think it's 14 pages, of James DeCoven. And in that, he mentions his family. There had never been anything that I could find about his family. I knew that he never married. That was obvious because he lived in the in Taylor Hall, but had no personal family and did not marry. But as I was looking through that, Father Crum, who, by the way, was an Episcopal priest and a librarian and an incredible researcher, he mentions the fact that he was one of 10 children and came from Connecticut. And, you know, so I'm interested in family genealogy. I've written 2 histories of my own family with the genealogy. I'm not so much interested in the genealogical studies, but as the family history, the stories that come down to us. And so that was one of the things that was curious for me. Most of the people who had written about him and his life had been Episcopal priests, but he was not always an Episcopal priest. He had what was his background? So that was one of my stimuli for my interest. Where can I find out about his life? And he had, it was a very interesting life.
Before we dig into that, I want to find out a little bit about what ended up being most valuable to you in terms of what you were able to explore. And in the publicity for the book, mention is made of previously unavailable sources.
Right.
What would be at least a couple of the most interesting examples of that?
Well, one of the problems and one of the difficulties in writing this biography has been the lack of letters. So many of the letters that I wish that I could find just are not available. There are, however, a couple collections. We have a series of letters that he wrote to a good friend starting in 1854 through the end of his life. So there are some collections of letters. There's a private collection which is not accessible in New York City, but what there are also letters that are housed in the National Episcopal Archives. So the letters, and the family was, members of his family were very proud of the fact that they didn't save letters and that they destroyed letters. They didn't want them to live on for some reason, which I find incredibly discouraging. One of the most valuable for me and for, I think, anyone who would like to know more about James de Koven's study is the fact that he did keep a journal, a personal journal, not regularly. He was not good about filling it in every day, but he started it in 1862, and it goes through the last 17 years of his life until 1879. This was known soon after his death in 1879. He died. And it was shipped to a friend of his in New York City. And then it started a pilgrimage of its own, it seems.
Finally, The journal.
Finally, in the 1990s, it was discovered in the archives of the National Episcopal Cathedral in Washington, D.C. Huh. In 1930, one of the bishops had learned of its existence, and he had a copy, typescript made of it. There are a lot of errors in the typescript. Well, not a lot, but it's enough errors to make it some questions. So that it is now online. You can have access to it, and it's and it is sort of his open. He expresses his feelings about different aspects of his life, and that is very meaningful.
Yeah. Sometimes when we read journals, it seems to me that sometimes they really feel like the private thoughts,
right.
a document in which someone can share their deepest feelings and maybe vent their harshest anger or whatever it might be, but it really is not written with any sense whatsoever that the rest of the world will ever see this. And then other journals clearly are written with, on some level, that intention, or at least acknowledging that possibility that someday the world might see this. And
that they're both aspects of that in his journal. He called the journal The Story of a College because he started it after he'd taken over Racine College. And he calls it Story of a College. And once in a while he does address the reader saying, and he said at the very beginning, the reason I'm writing this is we often forget what we've done, why we've done what we've done. And sometime in the future, maybe people will be interested in why this college was created and why I took over and what I did. So that's one of the interesting aspects. And other times you can tell that he's really just, he's frustrated or he's sad or he's alone, lonely. When I talked about his family, it was a large family. I mean, he had 9 of the 10 children lived to adulthood. He also had a lot of aunts and uncles. And one of his aunts even lived in Beloit, Wisconsin, and so had moved to this part of the country. So he was surrounded by family. He had 5 sisters. 3 of them married people that they met in Chicago. So I mean, it's just, and they were all the five sisters married very important men. One was the mayor of Chicago.
Hmm.
And they were involved in the meatpacking industry and lumber industry and land speculation. So I think I've lost my train of thought.
Yeah, no, you're just kind of talking about this big, substantial family.
Yeah.
And what a presence they had in the Midwest. So James DeCoven married and had children?
No, he did not.
No.
He never did.
He was just part of a big family.
Part of a big family.
Yeah. I just wanted to clarify that just for listeners, because in the Episcopal Church, even though you are priests in the Episcopal Church, but marriage is permitted and has been permitted for a long, long time.
Yeah.
So it's theoretically possible, but did not occur with him.
Did not occur with him. And at that time, there had been a slight movement among different thinkers about celibacy for the Episcopal priests. When Neshota House was established, which is in Delafield, Wisconsin, the young men who came to work there and to study there, they at first were not allowed to get married.
Hmm.
So that changed, though.
Interesting. That's what brought him to this part of the country,
right,
if I remember correctly.
Right.
For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with John Magaris, a former University of Wisconsin La Crosse professor and administrator, who has recently written a biography of James DeCoven, for whom, of course, Racine's DeCoven Center is named. The title of the book, James DeCoven, Biography of a Famous Yet Forgotten Man. And we're going to dig now into a few aspects of his life. Born in 1831, died in 1879. Not a particularly long life, but he's nevertheless managed to accomplish quite a lot. Tell us what you think is most intriguing or interesting about his early years, which I believe were lived in New England.
Right.
And this is an aspect of his life that, from what you said earlier, has not been written about extensively before this.
No. He was born in Middletown, Connecticut. His father was a sea captain. His parents were first cousins, so that makes working with the history of the family quite interesting, because at one point his uncle becomes his father-in-law, and a cousin becomes his brother-in-law.
And you get to sort all that out.
Trying to sort all that out, plus the fact that his grandparents was one of 11 children, so there are a lot of family. So he was born and raised in comfort. The home where he was born and raised still stands. Hmm. It's called the DeCoven House.
Ah.
It's close to the Connecticut River, which was the source of a lot of income for Middletown.
And they're in Middletown, Connecticut.
In Middletown, Connecticut. The descendants of different members of this family have played different roles in different places. But one would have been his great nephews eventually became one of the biggest landowners in Connecticut. And he was the one who kept this house in the family until the 1940s, when it was turned over to one of the first environmental foundations.
Hmm.
It's called I can't remember the name now, but it's an organization that promotes environmental protection of land. There are different aspects of that the family that live on.
Hmm. So even there in the region.
There in the region, yes.
Very good. So explain what it is that brings him to this part of the country.
He entered the seminary in New York City in 1870, and at the time the Bishop of Wisconsin was recruiting young men to come to Wisconsin to work at the seminary in at Neshota. And James DeCoven was motivated to help others, and also he was motivated to teach. He had, with two or three other seminarians, he had gone to the Bishop of New York City and asked to be allowed, once he was ordained deacon at least, to work among the poor and the neglected in the city. The bishop didn't have any way to fund that, and so he didn't allow it. And at about this time, then, James Jacobin was looking for a job. He was offered priest positions at two churches in New York City. Instead, he came out to Neshota to investigate it. This is in early 1854, which is unusual for someone to travel to sort of check out a place where they're going to a job at that time.
Right. Well, and yeah, you think about thousands and thousands and thousands of miles he traveled just for that.
I mean,
not knowing exactly what he would find.
But the interesting, the reason he could do this is he had two of his brothers-in-law were big, they were very big in the train industry, the beginning of the transportation industry. And his sister, his eldest sister and her husband were living in Chicago, so he stayed with them. He came out, checked out Neshota House, was interested. They offered him a job. He debated about whether he wanted to take it because he wanted more, a larger salary. He had asked for a salary of $250 a year. we don't know if he ever got it, but he was given the parish responsibility in Delafield, St. John, the parish, the Church of St. John Chrysostom, and he became the pastor there, as well as teaching church history at Neshota for the seminarians. And that's why he came to and it was bishop, the earliest bishop of Wisconsin, Jackson Kemper.
And I'm glad you mentioned his name because, of course, there's Kemper Center here
right.
in Kenosha.
Right.
So
right.
yet another towering name in the history of the Episcopal Church. And do I remember correctly that while he was in Delafield, he actually established some kind of school there?
Yeah, it was called St. John's Hall. It was a he did love teaching. He loved education. And that was a very strong point for him. And it was legally established as a boys' school. It was going well. One of the problems that Jacobin had was he was very strong-willed and he had definite ideas about what he wanted to do. And that did not always suit those who worked with him. And he especially was a strict disciplinarian, but it was a very more of a positive approach to discipline rather than a military approach to discipline. He wanted to establish, and he brought this about when he came to Racine and Racine College, was that he wanted to establish a family. He felt that young boys, and they were young boys, sometimes as young as 9 and 10 in the school, needed to be encouraged in their spiritual growth as well as their physical, intellectual growth by living with others in a family-like situation. And so that's when he eventually he did build, establish the school in Delafield called St. John's Hall, which was the predecessor of St. John's Military Academy. Many years after his death, by this time St. John's Hall had folded, but a former student who has came back and created St. John's Military Academy and based it, and there is to this day one of the large buildings on St. John's Military Academy is Jacobin Hall.
Ah.
Yeah.
Very good.
So
it is in the year 1859 that he makes the move to Racine.
Right.
And do we know very much about that invitation and that decision for him to leave Delafield and come to Racine? I mean, what prompted that?
Again, it was based on an issue of discipline. His feelings that there needed to be more structure in the life of the college or the school. He didn't get along with some of the other faculty members. I mean, they were polite, I think, and intellectually polite to each other, but not terribly encouraging for his ideas. There was the possibility that Racine College was not going to continue because the person who had been the founder of the school or the earliest president of the school was not a great administrator, and it seemed to be foundering. So there was a Jacobin was actually threatening to go elsewhere, to leave this part of the country, and a couple of the more powerful priests in the area suggested that he be moved to Racine and take over Racine College. So that's what he did. And they arrived with 32 young men that who were students at St. John's Hall, came with him to Racine, and that was the beginning of the Racine College under his administration.
Wow. So can you describe what that school was like? I mean, what kind of an institution of higher learning was it? And for the typical young man who attended it, what would have been the purpose of attending Racine College? I mean, what would it typically have led to in terms of the next chapter in a young man's life?
Well, it evolved as the years went on. But it was based on a classical education, and by classical education, I mean Latin and Greek were important, and reading the ancient writers was important. But de Koven also had some really progressive ideas about education, and he insisted on studying in mathematics and in sciences, and social sciences, which was unusual for that era at all. He tried to get the best professors that he could, and that was not always easy. But like I said earlier, he was insistent that it be a family group, and so the faculty members, when faculty members were hired, they lived in the buildings with the students.
On campus?
On campus, yes. And even if they had children of their own, those children lived on the campus too. So, and they ate all of their meals together, they prayed together, it was a religious school, so they had chapel services in the morning and chapel services in the evening. As time progressed, the number diminished somewhat, but he insisted that they eat together, that they pray together, that they play together, and that they work together. One of the differences between the James de Koven's idea of a boys' school and sort of the British idea of a boys' school is that everybody ate the same food. And he really insisted on good quality food and ample food for the students. I wish we could have some of the recipes of what they used, but when the school grew to its largest numbers, which was about 240 students, it was a large body with him, and you had all the other people that were also eating meals there.
Yeah.
It was quite a production. So,
and how many, in a sense, grade levels are we talking about? Or did that change over time?
That changed as the years went on. Sometimes there were young people as young as excuse me for a minute.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes there it varied over the years. Sometimes there were boys as young as 9 years old who were brought here, but James de Koven wanted it to be a little bit later, and so it was more like 10 or 11 years old when they started. And they had six forms that they were called. They weren't called classes, but six forms. He was pretty progressive in the fact that he based the students' level of what class they were in on their abilities, not on seat time. In other words, if you could write in Latin at a particular level, then you were put into the form where you were with your peers.
So it wasn't just for age.
No, it wasn't just for age.
It was for ability and experience.
Ability, yes.
Wow.
Yeah.
Fascinating.
Yeah.
I know that one of the things that he is fondly remembered for is the fact that he chose to remain in Wisconsin, in Racine, for essentially the rest of his life.
Right.
And my understanding is that he had very, I should think, tempting offers, or they would have been tempting offers from very, very large and wealthy parishes, probably back east, I'm guessing.
Yes.
And for some reason, never accepted any of those invitations from other parishes. What can you tell us about Father Coven's decision to remain in Racine?
The last years of his life were really years of turmoil, because he became involved in some of the major discussions that were going on about the Episcopal Church. One, it was essentially boils down to whether it was going to be primarily a Protestant religion or it was going to be a Catholic religion. And James de Coven turned out to be one of the strongest speakers in favor of what is called the Catholic, or the belief that the tradition of the church is more important than the changes that took place during the Reformation.
Hmm. So he wanted the Episcopal Church to be tilted more towards its Catholic predecessor rather than towards the Protestants who broke away.
Right. And, you know, I explain this to myself, and so as I make this explanation, it's probably I'm simplifying it a lot. People would say, well, it was much more involved in that. But he was a marvelous speaker, and he had an intellectual ability to express ideas clearly and succinctly. And so he started playing a role in what was called the General Convention of the Episcopal Church, which takes place every 3 years. And so he was famous for speeches that he gave there speaking about the role of the Eucharist, the different aspects of the Christian faith, and so he had enemies as well as supporters, because he used humor a lot. He loved jokes, and his humor was very intellectual and also very biting. It could be so he developed enemies as well as friends. He was. One of the things that happened at this time was several times he was nominated to be a bishop for different areas, different dioceses throughout the United States, including the Diocese of Illinois. He was elected and chosen to be the bishop of Illinois. But then there was quite a bit of controversy over that. And he was never consecrated or ordained as a bishop in the Episcopal Church, and that was a difficult situation for him.
Yeah, he dies in 1879. I haven't done the math yet, but he was
48 years old.
Yeah, so he died all too young. What were the circumstances of his death?
Well, he had been ill most of his life. I've found records that his first educational experience was in a boys' high school in Middletown. And in one semester, he was absent 31 times. He did not deal well with stress. But both of his parents died of heart problems. He had a brother who died. It was the first graduates of Annapolis, died of a heart attack. So his mother had a stroke. His dad had several strokes, and so he died of it. He himself died of a massive stroke. So it was a heart problem that, and he had significantly deteriorated in physical ability toward the end of his life.
Wow, perhaps in part because he lived life so fiercely. He was someone who did not remain on the sidelines or take the easy way. And certainly a man of principle. As you finished your voyage of research and discovery, if you will, did you come away with essentially a deep admiration for James de Coven?
I did, and I do. He believed strongly in what he believed in. I mean, his beliefs were part of his being. But he never insisted that other people had to believe like what he believed. He loved humor. He loved being with the students and the family that he had created at Racine College. That was part of his life. Towards the end of his life, his two of his sisters moved in with him in Racine and took care of him in the last three or four years of his life. So he was surrounded by family. He was an interesting character, believed strongly in education, and also believes strongly in the importance of spiritual life.
Hmm. Well, we, of course, have just scratched the surface of his life and legacy in this conversation, and I would encourage anyone listening who is interested in knowing more about James DeCoven to seek out the book that we have been discussing today, James DeCoven, Biography of a Famous Yet Forgotten Man, now available through Amazon and through other places where you can buy books, and the author, John Magaris. John Magaris, I have so enjoyed this conversation. It's great to see you again and to learn more about James DeCoven and to be able to imagine the man behind that familiar name. Okay. Thank you for your hard work on this book, and thank you for being my morning show guest today.
Thank you.
Tomorrow on The Morning Show, a conversation I just recorded with a wonderful British writer who is also a farmer, James Rebanks, and his most recent book, a touching memoir called A Place of Tides. In this book, James Rebanks talks about the experience right around his 50th birthday of deciding to go and live and work on a tiny remote island just off the coast of Norway. The memorable experiences which he had there are the heart and soul of this beautiful book. We'll hear that tomorrow on The Morning Show. Thursday, we have to make a change from our published schedule. We were hoping to speak with the executive director of Halo Incorporated. That will have to wait for another time. In its place, I'm replaying a delightful conversation that I recorded, I believe, 10 years ago with a very gifted local writer that many of you know, Linda Fleshinsky, who for a time was a co-host of our Education Matters program here at WGTD. We'll be sampling some of her wonderful writing in this replay on Thursday's morning show. And on Friday, we have a couple of special things for Pride Month. Part one, Robert Trachtenberg, the author of a book called When I Knew, which shares the stories of a number of gay people who talk about the moment when they first realized that, in fact, they were gay. Some of the stories are quite lighthearted and fun. Others are deeply poignant. In part two of Friday's morning show, I speak with Christopher Rice, son of the best-selling author Anne Rice, and we will be talking about his most recent book, a queer romance novel called Party of Three. The morning show airs every weekday morning between 8 and 9 o'clock. You'll find the morning show archived on our website, wgtd.org. And don't forget about the Morning Show podcast, which allows you to enjoy a different morning show 7 days a week. Look for the Morning Show with Greg Berg. Today is going to be a partly cloudy day. We have a 50% chance of some showers and thunderstorms developing later in the day, with a high today of 81 degrees, so not nearly as hot as it has been. The best chance of rain, right around 70%, is tonight. Showers and thunderstorms, overnight low of 62 degrees. And we show a 50% chance of showers and thunderstorms tomorrow Wednesday and into Wednesday evening. This is WGTD HD, Kenosha.